There's virtually no opposition from Indian country, and I think that that is important.
Tara Sweeney clears a Senate hurdle in her path to becoming Assistant Interior Secretary for Indian Affairs. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, new standards seek to keep vessels and the environment safe in the Bering Strait.
One accident in this region could lead to catastrophic results.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com.
Alaskan Tara Sweeney's nomination to be Assistant Interior Secretary for Indian Affairs cleared a U.S. Senate committee today with no opposition, though there might be one hang-up. Senator Lisa Murkowski says the committee should listen to the many Alaska Native and Native American groups that wrote letters endorsing Sweeney.
We've got supportive groups, including NCAI, the United South and Eastern Tribes, many, many more. There's virtually no opposition from Indian country, and I think that that is important.
Sweeney was in limbo for months while the administration tried to figure out how to treat her status as a shareholder in an Alaska Native corporation. Democratic Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico says he's satisfied.
I was glad to hear Ms. Sweeney commit to recuse herself from any matters, and I quote now, directly affecting or with respect to the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, end quote, including oil and gas development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
But Senator Maria Cantwell, a Democrat from Washington State, says she wants more clarification about the possibility of an exception to Sweeney's conflict of interest recusal.
I will be seeking in writing before a Senate vote whether she does plan to seek a waiver in the future. I'd like her to just answer yes or no in writing.
The Committee on Indian Affairs took a voice vote to advance Sweeney's nomination to the Senate floor. No word yet on when it will come before the full Senate. North and southbound lanes, speed limits, areas to be avoided. Those are just some of the safety measures in place in the world's busiest waterways. In the Bering Strait, though, there's nothing regulating where ships can go and what they should avoid. But as Alaska Public Media's Emily Russell reports, new standards were recently introduced to protect transiting vessels and the marine environment in the waters off northwest Alaska.
Ask Sharm Sederquist what the Bering Strait is like to sail through when conditions are good, and he'll smile.
You know, when you got a beautiful, calm night and everything's flat and you're just out in the middle of nowhere driving, it's kind of fun.
Sederquist is a captain for Cook Inlet Tug and Barge. He's made between 60 and 80 trips through the Bering Strait.
But when you're in a storm and nothing's going right, it's not as much fun.
Sederquist got his start fishing the Bering Sea, but now captains tugs that pull barges filled with things like freight or fuel. He says they plan their delivery schedule around the sea ice.
At the start of the season, you chase the ice north, you start working in Bristol Bay, then the Kuskokwim, then Norton Sound, and then after Norton Sound, you'd make your northern push up to Kotzebue, Wainwright, Kivalina, Point Lay, Point Hope.
Finishing out in Ukiagvik and Prudhoe Bay, most of the ships sailing through the Bering Strait are doing what Sederquist does. They're delivering goods to ports along Alaska's northwest coast. But unlike other international waterways, the Bering Strait doesn't have safety measures in place. There are no designated shipping lanes or shallow areas to be avoided. That's in part because, on average, the Strait sees the same amount of traffic in one season that the English Channel sees in a day. Still, that hasn't stopped environmental organizations from lobbying for regulations in the region for years.
One accident in this region could lead to catastrophic results.
Elena Argakova is an Arctic shipping advisor for the World Wildlife Fund.
The amount of wildlife, the diversity of wildlife, the fact that there are local communities that subsist on the marine mammals, and the fact that some of them are starting to be oil and gas tankers that Russia is sending to Asian markets.
Plus the lack of emergency response infrastructure. Those things together make the region ripe for disaster. Agarkova says at first, Russia wouldn't agree on regulations for the Bering Strait, claiming the U.S. was trying to control vessel traffic. But now Russia is trying to capitalize on the shorter route to Asia, so Agarkova says they saw the value in making the seaway safer.
The fact that U.S. and Russia have managed to come to an agreement on these measures, you know, despite broader political discord, is really heartening.
That agreement is detailed out on a map of the Bering Strait. The map shows north and southbound lanes laid out on either side of the Diomede Islands. It also highlights St. Lawrence, Nunavak, and King Island as areas to be avoided. The International Maritime Organization regulates shipping worldwide and approved these standards. But like a lot of international law, they're voluntary. Tug Captain Sharm Setterquist says, actually, that doesn't matter that much.
It's like a car. If you have a bunch of DUIs, no one wants to insure you. If you're a shipping company that has a bunch of problems, no one wants to insure you. And that's why they have these standards, and that's why people are held to those standards.
Those standards go into effect in the Bering Strait on December 1st. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Russell.
The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority violated state statutes by investing nearly $45 million in commercial real estate. The trust's board violated other laws by purposely trying to keep some board issues out of the public's eye. Those are the findings of a special audit of the trust released yesterday by the Alaska Division of Legislative Audit. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
The Mental Health Trust funds programs for people with mental illnesses, developmental disabilities, and other cognitive issues. Its current management system was established in 1994 after a settlement between the state and people who said the state mishandled the trust and didn't provide enough resources to support people with mental illnesses. In 2016, members of the public raised new concerns about the Board of Trustees' investments in communication, so members of the legislature asked for a special audit. The audit took 18 months. According to multiple state statutes, the trust's principal funds are to be managed by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Since November of 2008, the Board of Trustees has not given the money to the Permanent Fund. Instead, they held funds in a separate account and invested in commercial real estate around the country. Legislative auditors found this to be in violation. The Trust Authority disagrees with this finding, saying the law is more ambiguous. Mike Abbott is the organization's CEO.
We believe that there are several other guiding authorities that the trustees were required to follow in making investment choices. And the fact that the statute doesn't clearly identify alternative investment opportunities, other guiding authorities do.
Abbott says the board decided to invest in commercial real estate to increase the amount of spendable income available to trust beneficiaries.
That everything I've witnessed suggests that the trustees and the trust staff and the TLO staff never wavered from their desire to improve the lives of beneficiaries.
The audit recommends the trust stop investing in commercial real estate and consult with the Permanent Fund Corporation to determine what to do with their current investments. The trust is following the recommendations while also pursuing legislative changes that would allow them more latitude in their investment strategies. The audit also addressed concerns about the board's lack of transparency. The audit says, quote, evidence showed that multiple trustees were at times intentionally trying to avoid discussing board business in a public manner. Some board members conducted business via email without letting the entire board know. That included issuing a $1.3 million request for proposals and demoting former CEO Jeff Jesse in order to hire a new CEO. Current CEO Abbott acknowledges that the board has had problems with openness.
I think we agree that that the trust has not met the community's expectations regarding open meetings and public notifications in the past.
Abbott says the board has taken steps over the past few months to fix the process. He says they've rewritten guiding documents and are receiving more training. The legislative auditor declined to do a recorded interview for this story. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage's fire department announces the city's first female fire chief.
Most of my mentors throughout the entire time I've been in the service have been men because there weren't any other women in these positions to be mentored by.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
It looks like voters will not have a chance this fall to weigh in on a legislative ethics ballot measure. Alaska's Lieutenant Governor and the Attorney General's Office have determined a bill passed by the legislature this spring is similar enough to keep the issue off the ballot. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
More than 40,000 voters last year signed a petition to put the Alaska Government Accountability Act on the ballot. It seeks to end per diem pay for legislators if they fail to pass a budget in the first 121 days of a session. It would also toughen up state law on financial conflicts of interest for legislators, gifts from lobbyists, reimbursement for foreign travel, and campaign spending by foreign corporations. House Bill 44 passed in May would do many of the same things. Sitka Democrat Jonathan Christ Tompkins has backed both the ballot measure and the legislation. He prefers a public vote on the issue, but calls the reforms in the legislation a huge improvement over the existing situation in Juneau.
You know, the no budget, no pay concept, which I think is a substantial disincentive to be in session for days, you know, months and months and send out pink slips and all the dysfunction that we've seen these last 3 years. Some reforms with lobbyists buying legislators $100 dinners at fancy restaurants, which I think just disagrees with people's sense of probity and propriety, particularly when, by the way, we do get per diem every day, so we can buy our own meals, or should be.
The Attorney General's office looked at the ballot measure and the legislation and concluded the two were similar enough that the measure should be bumped off the ballot, and the lieutenant governor agreed. Prior to that decision, Governor Bill Walker in May said he'd likely sign the bill if it was found to be similar enough to the ballot measure.
I like the idea of it going to a vote in some respect. The advantage of that is it can't be changed for a couple of years. Once it goes to a vote, that's the advantage of that. So I like the people being able to say something about that. So, but if it's substantially similar, I think to veto it just so that there can be a vote, I think that's probably not in the best interest. But I do like the idea of people being able to vote on that. I do.
Walker also proposed cutting off both per diem pay and salaries for lawmakers if they didn't pass a budget by the 90-day session limit passed by voters back in 2006. That successful ballot measure hasn't impacted the length of sessions. Lawmakers have continued to meet well after the deadline, most recently last year, when it took multiple special sessions and the legislature waited until days before a shutdown of state government before passing a budget bill. Nikiski Republican Mike Chenault was one of 15 in the House voting against the ethics reform bill this year and says he doesn't know how effective it will be.
We stay in Juneau a lot longer anymore, but most of that's not due to the budget cycle. Most of that's due to the governor calling us back for either additional revenue measures or some other piece of legislation, gas pipeline, things like that. I think we can get our business done in 90 days. I don't think we should be there any longer.
Past legislatures have passed a bill keeping an issue off the ballot, only to turn around and repeal it later. The Constitution prohibits that within 2 years of the passage of a ballot initiative passed by voters. Those who oppose the reforms say they'll start making changes to the legislation in next year's session.
I personally feel the restriction of you know, no alcohol allowed to be purchased by a lobbyist in a dinner, you know, not a glass of wine, not anything, is a little ridiculous.
Sitka Republican Bert Stedman was among the six voting against the bill's passage in the Senate. Stedman expects the legislative council, made up of House and Senate members, to address any ethical problems for lawmakers, and he opposes the reforms in the bill.
So the legislature took action on it themselves, so we'll be back changing it next year. Frankly, there's some things in it that are just ridiculous. You know, it's a feel-good type of bill. We don't have the legislative ethic issues we had a decade ago anywhere near that I'm aware of.
Other lawmakers have said the reforms will make it so they can't afford to continue to work in the legislature. Supporters of the reforms, including Chris Tompkins, say they'll fight attempts to change or repeal the legislation next year. They can still challenge the ruling, knocking the issue off the ballot. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
Anchorage has a new fire chief, and for the first time in the history of Alaska's largest city, it's a woman. Jody Hetrick has been appointed to lead the Anchorage Fire Department. That's according to an announcement today from the mayor's office. Hetrick joined the department in 2012. She served as acting chief since the previous chief retired in May. Hetrick says now that her position is official, there are some internal initiatives that can go forward. She says that includes expanding the management of their emergency medical services.
Not that we were struggling there, it's just that it's as we do more and more emergency medical service response, we should have more assets in place to manage that operation. And it's just a leap that we haven't taken, and we've needed to take that for a very long time.
Hetrick also says the department has good staffing levels for its first responders, but needs to build up other staff. That means adding mechanics, inspectors, and others, as well as promoting personnel into some command positions. As for her promotion, Hetrick says she's proud and thankful to be the city's first female fire chief. She says she wants to encourage more women to get into emergency services, and she hopes to offer guidance as a female colleague with more than 30 years of experience.
Most of my mentors throughout the entire time I've been in the service have been men, because there weren't any other women in these positions to be mentored by. So I think that's why it's a big deal, is there should be more women in the fire service so that more of them move up through the ranks and are given these types of opportunities.
Hetrick was an assistant chief at the Anchorage Fire Department, then deputy chief in charge of day-to-day operations. Her past employers include the State Division of Fire and Life Safety, the Valdez Fire Department, and the Central Mat-Su Fire Department, where she got her start in emergency services. Early this morning, Anchorage Assemblymember Tim Steele announced that he would be resigning from his position due to a, quote, serious health issue. Steele has been on the Assembly since 2013, representing West Anchorage. He served on the Anchorage School Board, where he was president prior to joining the Assembly. Steele declined to disclose the nature of his health issue, but he says he's been aware of it for a few months. Steele says he would prefer to finish his full term, which ends in 2020, but that is, quote, just not possible.
Well, I think my constituents would be very understanding in that I've been in the community a long time, public service, a lot of it.
Steele has lived in Anchorage for more than 30 years and spent 14 years in public service between his time on the Anchorage School Board and the Assembly. Anchorage Assembly Chair Forrest Dunbar says there will be a process for filling Steele's Assembly seat once his resignation is final.
So the process is mandated by the Anchorage Municipal Charter, and it says that if it's more than 6 months away from a regular election, we are required to hold a special election.
Dunbar says the Assembly will have a work session this Friday to discuss a date for the special election and a filing period for those wishing to run for the seat. Dunbar says the election must be held within 60 days of the vacancy. Steele's planned resignation day is June 12th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The newest megaship to ply Alaska waters arrived in Juneau on Tuesday for the first time. The 4,000-passenger Norwegian Bliss was specially designed for sailing in Alaska and will be making weekly stops in Juneau through the season. Complete with rooftop water slides, a go-kart track, and up to 1,700 crew, the 1,000-foot vessel may be the largest cruise ship ever to call in Juneau. This was the third Norwegian Cruise Line voyage for passengers Tanya and Anthony Bindano from Las Vegas. They got going a bit late this in the morning. The ship was only scheduled to dock for a little more than 6 hours.
A lot of shopping.
We shopped. If we had more time, we would have went and seen the glaciers. Not enough time.
Brian Holtz, executive director of the Juneau Economic Development Council, said he's heard concerns about the short port calls from some businesses.
We encourage them to change their schedule for next year. We have heard that concern, and being the largest vessel or here in Juneau visiting Alaska, it would be better, certainly, for everyone involved if they could find a way to spend more time in our port.
Holst said seeing ships like the Norwegian Bliss bode extremely well for the future of tourism in Alaska. More than 1.1 million cruise ship passengers are projected to disembark in Juneau this year. Members of the Takukwan gathered today at Savako Park in Douglas for the raising of the Wolf Totem Pole. What began as a somber, rainy event became a sunny celebration of resilience as the pole was raised into position where the Douglas Indian Village once stood. Participants danced and sang around its base.
This is a great occasion for me. It's been a long time coming.
John Morris was a young man in 1962 when the city of Douglas destroyed his village to make way for a harbor and park. He watched his home burn, as well as the nets and fishing gear that was his family's livelihood. Now 78 years old, Morris said he and other members of the Oneida have had to live with the pain of that day for the last 56 years.
It represents the beginning of the healing for our people, and our people really appreciate the occasion today. It has been a long time that our people have been able to gather together in such a way, and it's a good way.
The project to erect the 40-foot totem pole has been in the works for several years. A similar totem pole went up last year in front of the Sayak Gastineau Community School in recognition of Tlingit graves that were unearthed there during a construction project in 2012. Gold Belt Heritage Foundation and the Douglas Indian Association sponsored the project. The totem pole was funded in part by a grant from the Department of Health and Human Services. A fisherman based out of Homer posted images on social media of halibut bycatch headed for the grinder at Kodiak's Trident Seafoods processing plant. The post got a lot of attention online and sparked criticism of Trident, the Gulf of Alaska trawl fleet, and a body that regulates the commercial fishing industry. Dacia Eaton with KMXT looks into why valuable fish like halibut would be discarded and the rules that regulate bycatch.
A conveyor belt whisks bright red fish with bulging quarter-sized eyes and spiny fins past workers inside Kodiak's Trident Seafoods processing plant.
Today we're processing rockfish caught in the waters around Kodiak.
That's Paul Lumsden, plant manager for Trident Seafoods operations in Kodiak. Trident is the largest primary processor of seafood in the United States and is heavily invested in Alaska.
We're a company built by fishermen for fishermen, and we don't just buy pollock or cod or crab or salmon or halibut. We buy everything that we can sustainably harvest and feed the world with. Halibut is a very important part of our business.
Longtime fisherman Eric Velsko says if Trident really cares about halibut and sustainability, some things need to change. He recently called out Trident on Facebook, posting photos and video of excessive halibut bycatch at the plant that appeared to be from the local trawl fishery and which was going to be turned into fish meal.
Totes full of halibut, and you know, obviously that had some markings and looked a little damaged. They weren't gutted or dressed, as we call them, long lines, which meant the only place they could have come off of was a trawl vessel.
In all, Velsko alleges there were around 15 totes, each containing about 1,000 pounds of fish. The images were taken in the fall of 2017, when a fellow fisherman captured them but wanted to remain anonymous. So Velsko posted the images to his Facebook page this May with a paragraph alleging wastefulness.
I just threw it up there, just not really thinking anything of it. And the next thing I knew, it was all kinds of people commenting and resharing it.
At last check, Velsko's post had been shared more than 500 times. The Trident plant in Kodiak processes many varieties of fish from all gear types. The majority of the fish processed at the plant is pollock, but they also process a significant amount of fish caught with bottom trawl gear, such as Pacific cod, flatfish, and rockfish. Bottom trawling involves pulling a net along the ocean floor. Sometimes they haul up halibut, too.
Every fishery has some element of bycatch, and it's impossible to just catch exactly what you're after.
That's Julie Bonney, executive director of Alaska Groundfish Data Bank and a paid advocate for the trawl fishery. She says the trawl fishery operates under strict regulations. They're not allowed to keep a single halibut. She says most are discarded at sea, but ones that aren't are sorted out and end up at the processing plant.
The plant is required to enumerate every one of those fish, and it goes on a fish ticket. NOAA enforcement examines every fish ticket, and if they feel that the vessel was egregious in terms of their sorting practices, then that vessel will get a monetary fine.
There's an overall bycatch cap of 1,705 tons for the Gulf trawl fishery. Bonnie says it's hard to tell whether the halibut that appears in Velsco's Facebook post was collected into those blue totes over one delivery or many deliveries of hundreds of thousands of pounds of fish headed for market. Paul Lumsden, the Trident plant manager, also saw Velsco's post.
I did see the photos, yes, and that was alarming to me. It was disheartening, to say the least.
But he says the images were taken out of context.
The frustrating thing is when you see a 30-second video like that and you don't know the background. When that video shows a full tote, 1,000 pounds of fish being dumped into a truck, gives a false representation like there's just tote after tote after tote after tote, and that's simply not the case.
Velsco, the fisherman who posted the video, says he believes what's happening with halibut at the Trident plant in Kodiak is legal, but immoral and wasteful. And it was especially upsetting to him in light of recent restrictions on the halibut fishery due to conservation concerns. And he says there's a reason he waited 6 months to post the photos and video. He wanted the issue to be front and center at the upcoming meeting of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which is scheduled to take place in Kodiak June 4th through the 11th. A report about observer coverage is on the agenda. In Kodiak, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman, Casey Grove, and Emily Russell in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Daisha Eaton in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Heroin is an opioid known for risks of addiction and overdose, but prescription opioids such as hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine can also carry these risks. If you're prescribed an opioid for pain, ask your medical provider about the risks and ask about alternative treatments. Learn more about opioid safety at opioids.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
If you're looking for business opportunities in the government marketplace, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center. Alaska PTAC helps businesses navigate the challenging process of the federal, state, and local government procurement cycles with offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks and delivers services statewide. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.